Today's episode of the podcast is sponsored by Dr. Carlo Bayraktarian.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Der Narek from St. Sarkis Church with a new episode of the podcast. As we do every week, let us start our program in our day with a prayer from the Divine Liturgy of the Armenian Apostolic Church. O Lord, you bless those who bless you, and sanctify those who put their trust in you. Save your people and bless your inheritance. Preserve the fullness of your holy church. Sanctify those who in love preserve the splendor of your house. Glorify us with your divine power and forsake not those who put their trust in you. Grant peace to the whole world, to the churches, to the priests, to the Christian leaders, to the Armenian Church, to the Republic of Armenia and the United States of America, and to their armed forces, and to all your people. For all good gifts and all perfect bounties come from above, from you, the Father of light, and to you is befitting glory, dominion, and honor, now and always, and forever and ever. Amen. Every time in my podcast, we play a song. Sometimes it's picked by me, sometimes it's picked by my producer, Mr. Greg, and sometimes it is picked by the friend of the show, Mr. Veh Bezdikian. But not every time I get the chance to speak with the singer or the author of the song. Today, we are playing a brand new song called Long, Long Way to Go, and I have the honor and the opportunity to speak with the artist behind this song, Mr. Khajak Zeytlian. Khajak, I knew you as a music connoisseur, but I never knew that you are a recording artist. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad to be here.
Is this your first project?
This is my first recording project, yes.
Tell us about the message of the song.
It's a cover. This is not an original song by me. I didn't write the music or lyrics. This is a Phil Collins song from 1985. It's off his album, No Jacket Required, which was the Grammy-winning album of the year for that year. It's an album track. It's not one of the singles that was released off the album. So a lot of people haven't heard the song if they don't know the album. The reason why I chose to cover this song was because, as you said, you wanted to know about the message of the song. I think the message is that there's a lot of stuff happening around us, mostly tragic. We see a lot of things happening in the world. I don't think a lot has changed since 1985. I think what has changed is that we even have more exposure to things that are happening in this world, good or bad. And the song calls to, it's almost like a play where it's asking you to switch it off or turn it off. But what it's really doing is saying that you should actually pay attention. And, if you choose to switch it off or turn it off, you are not doing what you're supposed to be doing, which is paying attention to all these things that are happening around you.
Excellent. You are presenting the song with a very good music video. I think when a person watches the music video, they will get the idea very well of what are some of the themes that you are referring to in this song. What are some of the images that you are showing in your video?
I didn't want to produce I didn't want to make a music video with the song where I was featured in the video itself. Because it's not an original, I didn't think that it was necessary for my face to show up. So I decided to do something which is done by a lot of artists lately, which is put a lyric video up on YouTube or some of the other streaming services. And lyric videos are great because it calls attention to the actual lyrics. And if you have a song where the lyrics are particularly poignant or important, lyric videos feature that better than another video where there's a constant image going across the screen. So it's a lyric video, and then there's a break in the song where a cello and some electronics play, and I took the opportunity for that break to present a few images, which basically show all the tragic things that's happening in the world. So I think I have a bunch of images about the environment, deforestation, flooding due to climate change, oil spills that happen to wash up on the beach, and then it goes into a more political theme where I have police brutality being shown, protests around the world, particularly girls protesting, and then let's see, what else do I have there? There's another image of just young people being either protesting or being affected by all of the things that are going around them. And then finally, I have one shot from Armenia that took place during the famous shot from Electric Yerevan that took place with the young men giving the bird, as they say, to the authorities. So
that's an image that it stands out in the production. And also another image that caught my attention is the bombing that I think it's taking place in Aleppo, Syria.
That's actually Gaza, but it wouldn't matter. What does it make a difference?
It's the Middle East.
It's the Middle East and people are being bombed. Even if it wasn't the Middle East, if it was anywhere else, innocent people being bombed for, on a mass scale like that is pretty devastating and pretty frightening. So,
Khajak, tell us about the process of the production. How did you record this song?
The process took a while because my producers are busy people. So I approached my producers, Date Vieriazarian and Jesse Starr. Jesse has a studio in Harlem called Shrine Studios. And I approached both of them that I wanted to do a song, record a song. And they were excited about it because they both like my voice. And they liked the song that I wanted to record. And first step was getting the instrumentation together. So Datev has an orchestra that she plays with during her live shows. She's a composer, she's a musician, and she's a performer and a teacher. So she has a band that she plays in when she does her live performances. She got her musician friends to come in. So a girl named Kate Victor was playing the cello. A fellow named Eric Neveloff was playing the flute. So a few of them came in and did some of the instrumental parts. And then once that was done, a couple of weeks later, I went in to do the vocals. And the vocals took about a good 9 hours to do, just because Datev is a perfectionist and she kept wanting to get the best out of me. So I kept repeating the song over and over. Plus, all the background vocals are me as well. So I had to do all the harmony parts, the top harmony and the bottom harmonies as well. So it took a while. It's probably, I'd never recorded professionally like that. So I didn't think I wasn't expecting it to be so grueling. They could have, she wanted the best vocal performance. So that's why it took so long. These days you could do a vocal performance in a few hours and then they can, auto-tune it and correct it for you. But I was really adamant about not having any auto-tuning or any fixing of my voice. I really wanted to give a performance. And I think my voice can handle it. And but I have to say that by the end, by the, eighth or ninth hour, I was getting tired. But that's just part of it. And then after that, we would meet at the studio to layer the track together, which would be like, make the arrangement of the song. All the parts had to fit in the right place with the right timing. After that was done, we, you know, once we approved the final arrangement of the song, the next step was to mix it. And, you know, I don't know if anyone knows what that entails, but that means getting all the little parts of the song to sound, to layer in the right way. The volume of all the parts, have to be in the right way, and all the effects are added, you know, all the echoes and all the reverb and all that stuff is added in, and, it makes the song, sound like it does now. I have to say, I've never heard my voice in a raw state, which is when they record you on a microphone and there's padding around you on the walls. It's like you're almost singing in a vacuum. Well, not quite, because in a vacuum you wouldn't be heard, but it's such a muffled kind of thing.
Isolated.
You hear that, yeah, it's isolated. So when you hear that through your headphones, it's very unnatural sounding, because most of us, when we sing or speak or whatever, use our voices. It's in a room and there's bouncing of, you know, the sound waves, and there's natural echoes and reverbs and things like that. So our ears are very not used to an isolated vocal like that. So it's kind of scary listening to your voice that way.
What about the music video?
The music video, I wanted something visual. You have to sort of these days place, if you want exposure, you need to place your thing, your work on YouTube, because it's very accessible. A lot of people actually use YouTube as almost like a radio DJ. So I knew that I had to place something on the video streaming services like Vimeo and YouTube. But I didn't want, just a bunch of nonsensical pictures, or I didn't want my face, or just the cover, the cover of the artwork that I had prepared for the song. So I just thought, the best thing to do is, point out the poignancy of the lyrics by, creating a lyric video. So that's what I did. It's not a terribly professional, quality. It's pretty amateur because I think I did it on iMovie. But I mean, it works. It conveys the message. I think it works. And, I think people like to look at something while they're listening to the song, and hopefully with all the images that I placed within that break in the song, it does convey the message, in the right way.
Is there any particular expectation that you have from this recording?
No. People keep asking me if why I did it. I do it because I've always wanted to record. I think I have a lovely singing voice, as they say. So I wanted to hear that voice recorded in a professional way. And the expectation is that I now what this has done is people are more curious about and they want to hear more. So I have to come up with original material at this point and record that.
Kajak, I hope you don't mind that we are playing your song on our program today.
No, not at all. I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, guys.
We wish you best of luck in your career.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I really had fun doing this. While I sit here trying to move you any way I can, someone's sunlight's turning a gutter somewhere. Turn it off if you want to.
switch it off.
My guest today is Der Stepan Baljan, the pastor of St. Gregory Church of North Andover. Der Stepan, welcome to the podcast. Ortnader.
Thank you, Ian Ortnader. Thank you, Der Narek.
I learned English when I was pretty old. Armenian was my first language, but I live in a reality where I have to talk English almost on a daily basis. Your experience was the opposite of that. English was your first language, and now you talk Armenian constantly. Let's start with that.
Sure. It's something I think about often, Derhar, and in fact, I have to get over a little bit of a barrier here now, because it's strange for me after 8 years as a priest and 10 years knowing you and being able to call you my friend to be speaking English with you.
That's right.
Because I'm used to reverting back to Armenian. Like many of our American-born Armenians in our communities, I was a third-generation American-born Armenian, and the opportunities that we had to speak the language were limited. Even though it was never a foreign language for me, I think somewhere in my subconscious it was always there, I always understood, but having the practical experience of speaking the language was something that, like many of us, evaded me. So I grew up in American schools, in the communities, in the neighborhood, speaking English. It wasn't until I was accepted as a candidate for the priesthood and by the permission of our prelate, Archbishop Oshagan, I was sent overseas to study at the Theological Seminary of the Great House of Cilicia, that I was first immersed in the Armenian language and forced to gain that practical experience and speak the language. It was a wonderful experience for me, and when I came back to the States, I continued my education in the Armenian language, and I still feel like to this day it's something that's evolving, growing, constantly being perfected, my ability to speak Armenian. But I think one of my principles when I was overseas studying in Lebanon was I tried not to mix any foreign words. No English words, which would have been the easiest, and then even some of the words that in everyday speech we like to mix in, like Arabic words or French words or Turkish words. I tried to always learn the right Armenian word and tried to speak that way as much as possible so that it wouldn't tempt the people that were around me to give up on me and just say, well, I'll just speak in English. It's easier for him to understand. I developed that rapport with the people around me, that they knew I meant business, that I wanted them to speak Armenian with me, and I wanted to speak Armenian with them because I knew there's no other way that I would have learned.
And it worked out for you because your Armenian is perfect now.
It did work out. And I think that coming back and making the transition here to the States was a little bit of a difficult transition, because I saw that in some circles there was a little bit of a laxness when it came to speaking the language. And there was a temptation for me when I got to a word or a phrase that I couldn't quite figure out quickly enough in my head how to express in Armenian, there was still is a temptation to revert back to English. But what I've tried to do, especially with our clergy brothers, our prelate, our vicar, and really anyone who comes up to me speaking Armenian in my parish, or those who I know are from overseas, whose first language is Armenian, even though they know English and speak English very well in their daily lives, I've always tried to make it a principle and make it clear to them that I want to speak Armenian with them. And then that starts a certain rapport where, before we know it, we're always speaking Armenian with each other.
I remember our first meeting. I was a graduate of the seminary, and you were just admitted, and we met in Antelias. Mm-hmm. And you went all the way there to study to become a priest. Tell me why. Why did you choose to become a priest?
I grew up in the church, and that's not a unique experience in and of itself. A lot of our young people grow up in the church. They grow up seeing the example of their parents and grandparents serving the church, and they want to continue that legacy by doing their part to serve. My experience was a little unique because I'm a PK, a priest's kid, and my father is a priest, and so I grew up with the sort of firsthand knowledge and was kind of a front row seat to what it meant to serve as a priest. And early on, probably in my adolescent or teenage years, I felt a calling to also serve as the priest. I believe that we're all called in one way to serve one way or another. And the task, I believe, for each Christian, each believer, is to discern how to best serve. And I felt that with the skills or talents that God had given to me, and also with the experience of growing up in a priest's family and as a priest kid, I felt that I could also be well equipped to serve as a priest. And of course, I knew at the time that one of my biggest challenges was going to be mastering the Armenian language. In fact, when I first sat down with our prelate, Archbishop Oshagan, in the fall of 2000 to discuss becoming a candidate for the priesthood, I remember I was in my father's office at St. Stephen's Church in Watertown, and he wanted to get an idea of what my ability to speak Armenian or read and write the language was. Even though we were speaking in English, he understood that I was not yet at the level proficient enough to carry on a conversation, let alone one that important. And on a book stand in the office was a copy of the Holy Bible in Armenian. And so he asked
What a way of a placement exam you had.
Yes, absolutely. So he asked me to get up and go over to the Bible, and whatever page it was opened up to, I think it was the Gospel of Mark, and it was the passage that said, Yev er zadig, yev parachagerats don. And he asked me to read that verse, and I read it because when I was a teenager, my father had taught me how to read and write the alphabet, and that was the key that opened the door to my eventually being able to learn. Because once you can read a language, read a sentence, then you can work on understanding the translation, the grammar, whatever it is, the vocabulary. And I read it. He was very impressed with the way I read, and he asked me, what does it mean? And I translated it for him. I said, it was the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And he was very impressed with that. Fortunately, at that time, I was an avid reader of the Bible. And I read from my Bible every day, which I still try to do.
And you passed the test.
I passed the test, and it was fortunately because I was familiar with that. But otherwise, the Armenian, the English, the biblical language, it was something that was all kind of there. It was simmering under the surface. It was ready to sort of burst out. I just needed the right avenue, the right path to take to get to that point.
Excellent. I want to step back a little and talk about your experience as a PK, because this is a very unique experience. Now, you were a PK, and then you yourself became a priest, and now you have your own children. Tell me about the transition.
The PK experience is a very interesting one, and I hope that, that your children will find that out someday. There seems to be a very nice camaraderie, kind of brotherhood among us, especially as the years have gone by and we've grown up with the kids, the children of the other priests in the prelacy. There's a certain special bond between us that we don't necessarily feel with our other friends. There's a lot of sacrifice that goes into being a priest's family. As you know, a priest is called to serve the people, serving God by serving the people, and therefore has to sacrifice a lot of his own life. And the priests, Yeretzkin and children, also have to make a lot of sacrifices too, something for which the priest very much appreciates those sacrifices. When you think about some of the most basic pleasures in life, like the ability to travel, or to visit with family, or to spend weekends catching up on work or rest. Those are things that a priest and his family do not have, that sometimes other people might take for granted. But we understood that in exchange for that, we had the joy of worshiping the Lord, serving in his house, being with the people, forming those kinds of relationships and having that kind of fellowship in the community that, let's say, children from a different type of family might not always have. So we grew up with lots of aunties and uncles, extended family, because we didn't have any family where we lived, because usually priests are transplants into the community. But the community really looked after us like we were their family. And it's very interesting that since I have become a priest, wherever I have served, the community accepts me and my family with very much the same approach, with very much the same style, as kind of one of their own, as one of their sons and his family. And it's just a really wonderful thing to experience. Although, like I said, it entails a lot of sacrifice, and that's okay. The Lord rewards that.
How is your relationship with your own children? Now, because you've been in their place. Mm-hmm. You know exactly what it felt like to be a priest kid, and now you're their dad.
The way I try to relate to my children, who are very young still, 4 and 2 years old, I try to be their dad as much as I can, even when I'm in the church setting. Now, obviously, when I'm busy conducting the services, the Badarak and Jamir Kutyuns, there is a sense where they understand that I'm off limits to them. And that is something that's evident just in the layout of the church, in my body language, sometimes in the looks that I give them. They realize that Baba is not available to them right now. And I think they respect that. But when we're having fellowship together, when we're mingling with the people, they always love to come and stand right next to me when I go to bless the table. I have my two helpers, my two sidekicks right next to me holding my hands. And I don't think that they would trade that experience for the world. Sometimes it gets challenging when I'm called away, like I am this week here in Pennsylvania. And especially as they get older, this was the first time when Nishan, my oldest, when I told him I was going to Pennsylvania, he looked right at me and he said, "I don't want you to go anywhere, Baba." And of course, that hits you right in your heart.
Heartbreaking, yeah.
But at the same time, I believe that it's building a certain kind of understanding, appreciation, and respect for the priesthood and the service that goes along with it. And I know that when they get a little older, they'll appreciate the sacrifice that their father made. And just like I had to have that sacrifice as well, I grew up to admire and appreciate my father for all that he juggled as both the father of a spiritual community and also the father of a family as well.
Der Antranik is a fatherly figure to all of us, your cohorts, Der Heir. We have a great deal of love and respect to him. Der Heir, tell me about your vocation as a priest. Tell me about the parishes that you have served and your experiences that you've gained.
My experience has been very fortunate in that I have served many different parishes in different capacities, and I see them, those experiences, all as equally valuable in my formation as a person and also as a priest. Like I said, growing up as a priest kid, I was catapulted very early into service to the church, something for which I'm very grateful. So that even in my own parish that I grew up in, which was St. Gregory Armenian Church in Indian Orchard, Massachusetts, from a very early age, I was serving on the altar. And then once I had a little bit of piano training under my belt, I started playing the organ there. And I was very active there. I was ordained a deacon at a young age, the age of 16, in 1996, by the late Archbishop Mesrop Ashjan of blessed memory. And I remember for a stretch of several years playing the organ one week and serving as deacon the next week, alternating back and forth. And here I was as a teenager and college-age student bringing my service to the church and gaining from that experience. After my father was transferred to St. Stephen's Church in Watertown, we also served there. We got to see a very different type of community and meet a lot of new people. And then after I came back from the Antillas Seminary, I was assigned as the pastoral assistant at St. Vartanats Church in Ridgefield, New Jersey. And I was able to bring my service to that parish as well. I went back to St. Stephen's and served there as an intern for a couple of years before my ordination. And then those, all that being as a deacon or as a lay person. And then finally, when I was ordained in 2008, I was assigned to be the pastor of St. Gregory the Illuminator, Armenian Apostolic Church in Granite City, Illinois. And then 5 years after that, assigned to, you guessed it, another St. Gregory parish in North Andover, where I am now. So in each one of these parishes, I've seen unique strengths, also seen the challenges that each parish has faced. And in light of those, I've seen kind of where I fit in, where my service fits in, both as a musician, as a deacon, as a PK, a priest kid, and as a priest serving there. And also, too, now as a father as well to my own children, as a family man, quote unquote, and the new dynamic that that brings in interacting with my parishioners as well.
Leading as an example. Derhar, you mentioned that you're a musician, and we know that. You know, every time that you see an organ, we know that Derhar Stepan is playing on the organ. But I've also seen that you have a very unique interest for liturgy. Tell us about those two aspects of your service.
I began my musical training at a very young age. At the age of 8, I started with piano lessons. By the time I was in high school, I had completely sworn off any kind of popular music, and I was immersed in classical music. It became one of my greatest loves. I decided to pursue that as a career, and pursued a degree, a bachelor's degree in music theory and composition, which I received from the University of Massachusetts in 2001. Even though at the end of that time I decided it was time to pursue my life's calling to become a priest, I vowed that I would always keep up with my music and that I would always use my musical talent to help my ministry. When I went to the seminary, and even before, there was a little spark that had developed in me where I became very passionate about our prayer and worship life as an Orthodox church. I realized very early on that we had a real gem, a jewel in the way that we worshiped, whether it was the hymns that we sang, the prayers that we prayed, and or the way we used the Psalms, and also the prayers of our church fathers. I knew that there was something unique there. When I arrived at the seminary, the dean at the time was the former Father Bartev Gulumyan, who had just arrived back from the Pontifical Oriental Institute in Rome. He had been studying there, and that is known as a center of liturgical studies in the world, and that's greatly due to the efforts of a wonderful Catholic priest named Father Robert Taft, who's considered kind of the grandfather of liturgical studies. Anybody who has become any kind of liturgical scholar in the Eastern Church has studied under Father Taft. And so Father Bartev at the time definitely enacted that interest in me, as well, we learned the origins of our hymnology, of our zisakirutyun, our liturgical practice, and also the canons of our church, the calendrical study of our church. All of these things fascinated me. Later on, when I continued my studies at St. Nerses Armenian Theological Seminary and St. Vladimir's Orthodox Theological Seminary, I was again exposed to liturgical study, and it furthered my interest. I was fortunate that our dean there was Father Taniel Findikyan, who had completed his doctoral work at the Pontifical Oriental Institute under Father Taft, and today is considered the foremost liturgical scholar in the Armenian Church. And that is where I really truly understood and gained the greatest appreciation for liturgical study, because he, Father Findikyan, helped me to understand one thing, that liturgy serves a function. Liturgy brings us close to God and brings God close to us, helps us to understand and leads us to spiritual life and worship. And if the liturgy is serving its function correctly, meaning bringing the people to prayer and worship and understanding, I believe it can solve most, if not all, of our church's problems. Because once we're gathered together in the right spirit, to pray and sing, and we know what we're doing, and we're engaged with the meaning, then everything else, I believe, will come clear.
Absolutely. Dear Stepan, this has been a very wonderful opportunity to let our listeners know about you and learn from your experiences. But before we conclude, I would like to give you the opportunity to give your message to our listeners.
Well, thank you, Dad Hyde. I want to first start off by commending you for undertaking this project. I have to say you'd probably get the award for the most unique idea in the ministry. And we're always looking for new and innovative ideas. That's something I get coming from the artistic world. As you know, all the great works of art and literature and music always are great because they revolutionize the genre. They somehow do something bold, something new, something that hasn't been done before. And so with this podcast, I think among our clergy brethren, I think you have distinguished yourself as doing something new and innovative, and I hope you continue to find success in this endeavor.
You're hired for my campaign. Thank you very much.
Okay. I guess my message is very simple. It's the message of the gospel, that Jesus Christ, our Lord, loves you all, and that our Holy Mother, Armenian Apostolic Church, takes care of us. She takes us under her wing and nurtures us in the life of faith and spirituality. And I urge you all to be engaged in your faith and to always remain in the safe harbor of and the loving arms of the Armenian Apostolic Church.
That's a wonderful message, Dad Hyde. Thank you very much for this opportunity, and may God continue to bless you.
Thank you, and same to you.
Ortender.
Let's do the Bible reading and reflection now. This is something that we do every week here on the podcast. One of the readings today is from the Epistle of St. Paul to the Hebrews, chapter 11. Now faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commanded for. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. And the reading goes on, because today the Armenian Church remembers all the patriarchs from the Old Testament. And in this chapter, in the letter of Hebrews, the author gives examples from the patriarchs of faith, like Abraham and Moses, and about how they believed in God. But when I read this specific passage from the New Testament, I remember my years as a seminarian in the Armenian Theological Seminary, and I remember the Book of Catechism of the Armenian Church, where we learned about faith and the definition of faith, and that definition came from this letter. Faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. Today, this may sound nonsense to a lot of people, because we are part of a sophisticated culture. Everyone needs evidence. Everyone wants research. We need to compare number and stats. But there's so much that numbers and stats can do. Faith is an essential part of our being. A famous theologian once said that a human person needs the two elements. We need reason and we need faith. There's this saying that people often repeat, that when you come to church, you need to check your brains at the door. And I do not agree with that. Because without your brains, without your reason, you will never be able to grasp anything about your faith, about your church tradition, about your theology. But there's so much that reason can do for you. And beyond that, we need faith. Therefore, my brothers and sisters, as we read last Sunday in the Gospel of St. Matthew, the invitation of Jesus Christ that we need
to become like little children, to have an open heart, and to receive things with faith. Let us do that. And when we do that, we will see a dramatic change in our lives. We see things going smoother for us. We will see that we are really accepting God in our lives. The hymn today is called Horjam. This is a very unique hymn because this hymn was recorded in Halep by a punk rock drummer whose tour got canceled, and as a result he went to Aleppo. And he was fascinated by the Christian music that he found there. He visited a number of churches, Armenian and non-Armenian, and he wanted to record samples of the music. The hymn Horjam is performed by Der Anton Igzakchanyan, who is a graduate of the Armenian Theological Seminary. This was done before the war, and probably this is a good sample that reminds us of the famous church of Karasumanuk in Halep, which part of it was destroyed because of the war. As we listen to this hymn, let us pray for our brothers and sisters, the Armenian community in Syria. Let us pray for peace to prevail. I will be back next week with a new episode of the podcast. In the meantime, I would like to thank all my listeners, my producer, and our sponsor. May the peace of our Lord Jesus Christ be always in your hearts.
Today's podcast was brought to you by Dr. Carlo Bayraktarian. If you'd like to sponsor future episodes, please contact the St. Sarkis Church office at 718-224-2275.